It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on 89.1 FM WBOY Fort Wayne. We're focusing today's conversation on kidney transplants, and we hope that you join us by giving us a call with any questions or comments at 260-452-1185. You can email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post right on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. In recognition of April being Donate Life Month, our show today focuses on living donor kidney transplantation. Our featured guests include Dr. Tariq Kazilishik, transplant surgeon and director of the Lutheran Hospital Transplant Center, Valerie Barto, living donor transplant coordinator at the center, and April Boggs, who quite successfully donated a kidney to her father on March 14, 2012. Our welcome to all of you. Until kidney dialysis was developed in the 1940s, death was the only outcome for patients with chronic end-stage renal failure. Dialysis, while unpleasant and expensive, removes waste products from the body and prolongs life. But it was felt that there had to be a better approach to the problem. While the first kidney transplant from a deceased donor occurred in 1950, the first successful living donor transplant was performed in 1954 between identical twin brothers, whose similar genetic makeup prevented rejection of the transplanted organ. Rejection of the transplanted kidney by the recipient, whose body sees the new kidney as a foreign tissue, was a major stumbling block in attaining a successful transplant. Once immunosuppressive medications were developed in 1964 to prevent rejection of the transplanted kidney, living and deceased donor transplants from even unrelated donors became possible, although a close matchup of blood and tissue types is preferable for a successful outcome. By 2006, almost half the kidney transplants in the United States were from living donors. Dr. Kazilishik, what are the advantages of living donor kidney transplantation versus transplantation from a deceased donor? And what is the percentage of living donor transplantation that is performed at the Lutheran Transplant Center?
Well, living donor kidney transplants, comparing to cadaver transplants, have both short and long-term advantages. The short-term advantage is that a living donor kidney should start working immediately when you transplant, which means the patient starts making urine immediately. Versus in cadaver kidney transplants, there's a 30% chance that, which we call the kidney, would be sleepy to start with, and it may take some time before the kidney opens up and starts making urine. And in the long term, living donor kidneys last longer. A cadaver kidney transplant typically lasts about 8 to 10 years. A living donor transplant should last, well, between 15 to 20 years. And in terms of our transplant program right now, exactly half of the transplants that we do are living donors.
Who are the patients that are clearly on either on dialysis that have end-stage renal disease or have either congenital or acquired diseases that bring them to the point of requiring a kidney transplant?
When we look at our group of patients that are on the wait list for a transplant, 70% of them are either diabetes or hypertensive patients, and most of them are both diabetic and hypertensives. So diabetes and hypertension make about 70% of our patient population.
And most of the people on the waiting list are on dialysis?
Yes, obviously.
And what about congenital diseases? Are there congenital issues that can lead one to requiring a transplant, as in April's family?
That's correct. Patients may be born with one kidney or both kidneys are defective. Again, those congenital problems may end up having end-stage renal disease. Genetics may play a role with that, hereditary problems. Basically, any cause that causes the kidney to fail is an indication for kidney transplant.
And you know, Dr. Silsek and Valerie, what is the process? How are these patients selected, identified? Do they get on the waiting list? How is this done, and how do you take over coordinating this process?
For the recipients, they go through extensive amount of testing just to make sure that, you know, the risks versus benefits do not outweigh one another. So they go through extensive testing just to make sure that they're appropriate candidate. For the living donor, they're also go through extensive testing to make sure we're not going to put any harm to the donor. That's a huge thing for us, is that we don't want to put the donor at an increased risk of developing kidney disease themselves later on. So if a patient does not meet the criteria, then we will not proceed for the living donors.
And there are contraindications on both the donor part and the recipient part for consideration for transplantation. What are those?
For the living donors, any patient who is found to be diabetic, they're automatically ruled out. If a patient is diagnosed to have high blood pressure or any type of kidney stones or kidney issues at all, you know, they are also ruled out. For the recipients, we look at their vascular system to make sure that Dr. Kozeloshik can technically tie the kidney into the patient and have it work appropriately. We look at the heart issues. We have a pretty extensive criteria, you know, that we look at.
But patients with chronic heart disease or chronic lung disease, severe hypertension, would not be good candidates?
Well, we basically send the patients. See, this is a multi-specialty subject, and transplant is a multi-specialty endeavor. We have cardiologists working with us, pulmonologists. If we suspect a cardiac issue, we get a cardiac clearance. We suspect a pulmonary issue, we get a pulmonary clearance. We have to make sure that cardiac and pulmonary-wise, the patients are okay to have a transplant.
It's been my understanding that you have to do psychological evaluations on both the donor and the recipient as well. The donor to make sure that they're doing this in a non-coerced way, and the recipient to make sure they will comply with your very extensive medication regimen and follow-up therapy. True?
That is correct. Yes. Both the donor and the recipient both meet with our social worker, and if they determine that we need to have clearance from a psychiatrist, then we'll proceed to send a patient to a psychiatrist for their clearance, for their okay.
Valerie, do you find that you, in your line of work, do you mostly work with relatives of people that need kidney transplants, or are there folks that just for out of the goodness of their heart want mm-hmm. to be able to provide a stranger with a kidney?
Sure. Most of our patients, our living donors, are direct donors, so they know somebody who is on the wait list. I would say probably around 30% or so is actually a family member. It can be a spouse, though. It can be a family friend. It does not have to be a relative. For somebody who does not know a person on the wait list, it's called an altruistic donor, and we have completed approximately about 3 or 4 of those. They are not as common as the direct donations, but, you know, it's a truly wonderful gift that these patients, you know, step forward just to help somebody.
I want to remind our listeners that this is Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. And if you have a question or comment, you'd like to know a little bit more about kidney transplants, give us a call, 260-452-1185. The lines are wide open right now. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us. It's middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Dr. Kozeloshik, once you have a candidate for a transplant, there are immunologic studies that you need to do on this patient to make sure they will accept the foreign tissue. What then procedures take place?
We look at their what we call PRA. It's a panel reactive antibody, and basically it's the percentage of the antibodies that have against the donor pool in this in the area. The higher the PRA they have, it means that the chances are higher that they would have preformed antibodies against an antigen, which is the organ in this case. And then when we find a donor and we're ready to transplant, actually we do a final cross-match. Cross-match is basically mixing the recipient's antibodies to the potential donor's antigens to see what kind of a reaction is there going to be, if there is any. If there's any reaction there, which is cross-match positive, then we cannot proceed with the transplant because the body will reject that organ. The cross-match result has to be negative. Once we get a negative result, cross-match result, we proceed with the transplant. That means that we can safely transplant, and most likely the recipient immune system is not going to aggressively react to the donor antigens. That doesn't mean that it's not going to react at all. It will. But we can prevent that with immunosuppressive medications, which are called anti-rejection medications at that point.
And do you give that before and after the transplant?
Before the transplant, we start with induction medication in the operating room. They were giving intravenously. It's followed by the next 3 days after the transplant. And then we switch to maintenance immunosuppressive medications, which are given orally.
And these medications will need to be taken for the rest of the patient's life, as long as the kidney is functioning?
For the rest of the kidney's life, yes, that's correct.
What sets a patient up to have anti-human tissue antibodies?
There are some high-risk patients. For example, in women, multiple pregnancies, blood transfusions, previous transplants. So with those instances, you get a foreign body, and our body will develop an immune response and will remember that. So we'll develop those antibodies, and they will stay in our immune system. So that sets us more vulnerable or immune response to any foreign antigen.
In England, they mentioned that an extreme number of patients waiting for a transplant are patients that had previous transplants. So this setup of having had previous transplants is not uncommon. Do you run into this?
Yes, we do.
Also?
Actually, 25% of our recipients had previous transplants, and we had to transplant for the second or for the third time. And those patients are the ones who will have higher PRAs, panel reactive antibodies, actually. And to find a cross-match negative organ for them, it's much more difficult. And actually, those are the patients who wait on the waiting list longer.
And will they usually require a deceased donor transplant?
Not necessarily.
You do find living donors for them,
well,
too?
Well, yes. If you can find them, it'll be better. And when you look at it, actually, the way it is set up, if a patient is on the cadaver list, which means that the patient does not have a living donor, that's why the patient is on the cadaver transplant list.
What is the actual surgery itself? Starting with the donor, what is the surgical procedure that you do on the donor, which in recent years has become the less invasive laparoscopic surgery, and then what is the surgical procedure you do on the recipient?
The donor and recipient surgeries happen simultaneously in adjacent rooms. The donor is in one room and the recipient is in the other room with a connection between those rooms. We do donor surgeries here in our hospital, Lutheran Hospital. We started laparoscopically. Actually, we are exclusively using the Da Vinci robotic system right now. Our living donor surgeon is Dr. Mark DeBeja. Basically, he takes the kidney out in a laparoscopic fashion, but with the help of the Da Vinci robot. The final incision is about 2 to 3 inches long, which used to be 10 inches in the previous years. And then once the kidney is out, he passes the kidney to me. I do necessary things to prepare the kidney, flush the blood through the kidney, flush it with a preservation solution, make sure that everything is okay, prepare the artery and the vein for anastomosis, for hookup. And then I take the kidney to the recipient room, where the recipient is already prepared surgically, which means the incision was made. I created a space to put the kidney in. The artery and the vein going to the right or the left leg are prepared for hookup, for anastomosis. And then I bring the kidney into the field. And, of course, the kidney comes in with artery, with vein, and with a ureter. So I have to do 3 hookups minimum, the artery, the vein, the ureter. I hook up the artery to the artery going to the right leg or the left leg, the vein coming from the right leg or the left leg, and the ureter, hook it up to the bladder. And then the surgery is completed.
And that usually takes how many hours?
usually it takes about 1.5 to 2 hours, but there have been cases where I have been in the OR for 6 hours. You never know.
And with the living donor kidney, the kidney very quickly starts functioning?
Actually, after we complete the arterial and venous hookups, the anastomosis, before the ureter is hooked up, you see the urine coming from the ureter.
We need to take a quick break here on Health 360 Midday Matters. But in the meantime, if you have a question or comment about kidney transplants, give us a call, 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. It's 1222, and we'll be back in just a few moments.
On the next Fresh Air, the evolution of the new military intelligence complex, in which the CIA does targeted killings and the military's special forces take on spying missions. We talk with Mark Mazzetti, a national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Listening is great, but what Americans really love to do is talk. And thanks to Talk of the Nation, you can do both. I'm Neil Conan. Join me for insightful conversations with the day's newsmakers, the sharpest analysts, and your friends, your neighbors, your family, and your coworkers. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more at phpni.com.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC, local financial advisors who help people just like you. More information on Reinbold and Anderson on the web at reinboldandanderson.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on 89.1 FM WBOY Fort Wayne. It's 1224, and we'd love to hear from you with any questions or comments on kidney transplants. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio today with my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, and we're diving into the world of kidney transplants. And we're going to be shifting gears slightly, and I'll let Peter, you can go on and interview introduce our next guest who's with us in the studio.
We're very pleased to have April Boggs with us, who donated a kidney to her father on March 14th, 2012. And we'd like to know more about her experience. April, tell us about your family history of polycystic disease, your father's condition leading him up to requiring transplant, and how it came about that you became his donor.
Sure. My grandmother had polycystic kidney disease, and she actually passed from it. My uncle, my dad's brother, has received a kidney from a cadaver donor, but he was a 6 out of a 6 match, which is very rare. It's like winning the lottery. And my dad's 2 cousins both have received kidney transplants as a result of the polycystic kidney disease. My dad is very private about his health issues and actually was on the transplant list for a year before I even was aware of it. So I don't know what his reasons were for not telling. I maybe think that he knew I would immediately say, it's going to be me. I remember sitting in our kitchen and him telling us, I'm on the kidney transplant list. And immediately I said, well, I'll give you one of mine. You know, I've got 2. I don't need them both. So he was very hesitant to allow me to do that because there's a lot of stigma I feel surrounding the kidney transplant surgery or the donation surgery, it seems like it's going to be such a huge ordeal, and it's a very, you know, seems to be a very dangerous procedure. But I called Valerie Bartow at Lutheran, and she sat down with me and explained to me the risks and rewards of the surgery. It's no more dangerous for you, or no more, there's no more risk involved than a typical appendectomy. So once I was able to talk to my dad, armed with this knowledge, it becomes a lot more beneficial, a lot more possible to do without fearing for your child's safety. Obviously, as my dad, he didn't want me to enter into a risky situation that would endanger my health in order to benefit him. But like I said, armed with knowledge from Valerie, we were able to work through those issues.
April, was there anything that you were personally concerned about walking into the surgery? Anything of your own personal health that, you know, kind of scared you?
Sure. Polycystic obviously has a very strong genetic tie. And it's something that if it shows up in your body at my age, it would be there if I had that disease. And so obviously I was concerned or anxious about what they would find, but I was in perfectly good health. And as Dr. Kozilashek shared, they do a very thorough testing of you to make sure. So that's kind of a boost in the arm for me. I'm in excellent health and able to donate a kidney. I was actually a little unbearable to live with. As my family would say, I would walk around saying, I'm in perfect health. Look at this perfect kidney.
And you said you and your brother both did not inherit the tendency towards polycystic kidney
disease. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
We both are free from the disease.
How did you experience the surgery itself? How much of a problem was it, and how quickly did you recover?
Well, Dr. DeBeja was my surgeon, and I met with him. And the procedure, we have to go in early in the morning, and you go back to the operating room. And I believe that my surgery maybe was about 2 hours as well. And the next day I went home. It was like Dr. Kozilashek said, you have a very small incision that heals very quickly. And within a week, I was back to work. I would have actually gone back earlier if my dad hadn't insisted that I wait for the doctor to clear me for work. It was very easy to come back from. And currently, I have no physical inhibitions or any side effects, or I don't feel any differently than I did before the surgery took place.
And Dr. Kozilashek, the long-term outlook for the donors in terms of kidney function, longevity?
Is excellent. There's no difference comparing to the general population. Actually, when you look at it, there was a study done when they first started doing these kidney transplants, as you said, in 1954, because that first kidney transplant was between identical twins. And they had this concern at that time. What's going to happen to these donors who are now left with one kidney? They did a study, created two groups. One group, they put all the potential donors who gave a kidney, now left with one kidney. The other group is a control group, demographically matched, height to height, age to age, weight to weight, man to man, woman to woman. And they started following these two groups, comprised of thousands of people. When they look back after 25 years to get the initial results, they realized that living donors actually live longer. Why do they live longer? Is it because they gave a kidney? No, it's not. It's because they were healthier to start with. Mm. That's why we do those million-dollar studies, to make sure that they're completely healthy and nothing is going to happen to them. So after that, we choose a donor and take a kidney. And although they are now left with one kidney, they still outlive the normal population.
I read that the one remaining kidney will tend to hypertrophy, get a little larger to do the function of two. Is there any further information on that?
If it needs to be, yes, it will. But not under normal conditions, no.
It doesn't happen.
One kidney is more than enough to sustain life and to have a normal life.
April, what is the how does your father and relate to you now, knowing that he's got your kidney inside of him? How does it make him feel?
Well, I love to joke with him, because I'll tease him, you know, you've got girl parts, and we'll all do those kinds of jokes. And then I also will, I don't know if you're familiar with the story in White Christmas, where Danny Kaye's character saves Bing Crosby's character from a falling wall, and then throughout the rest of the movie, he'll rub his arm, and he'll say, well, you don't owe me anything. So I'll tease my dad, and I'll rub my belly, and I'll say, you don't have to take me out to dinner, but I don't want you to feel any obligation to me. It's been really good. You know, my dad was very ill before he received his kidney, and we're a close family. I can't imagine my family without my dad. And so one of the things we said, though, we're not going to get weird, you know, we're not going to be goofy or silly about it, to where it's just part of our normal, everyday life. We don't talk about it. We don't think about it. You know, for me, there's nothing to remind me really of the surgery. He obviously has to take the medicines on a daily basis, but it's just good to see him healthy and enjoying his life.
Does he have a good quality of life at this point?
Absolutely.
And functioning in a normal way?
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, the way that the medicines have advanced, he is really on a very low dose compared to my uncle, who had a transplant surgery over 20 years ago. The medicines that he had to take were much more invasive in his life. He had to take many more pills, whereas my dad's on a very low dose of medicine, and it's been monitored and limited so that he has a very normal life. He goes on vacations, you know, he's able to travel and have a very good quality of life.
I want to remind our listeners that this is Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY 89.1 FM. And if you have a question or comment about kidney transplants, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185. Maybe you're someone out there that's received a kidney or someone who's donated. We'd love to hear your story. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. April, you mentioned that you had a bill of perfect health, which made you a prime candidate to donate a kidney to your dad. But were there any lifestyle adjustments you had to make before surgery or post-surgery at all?
Absolutely none at all. You know, the way Valerie explained to me, you could have just a regular, normal life. If I even wanted to have more children, I could, you know, successfully carry another child with only one kidney. There are no limitations to me at all physically.
Dr. Kozilacek, the medications that that April's dad has to remain on, it all transplantation patients remain on for the rest of their lives, the immunosuppressive medications to prevent rejection of the transplanted kidney. What are these medications? What are the side effects? And could you tell us more about them?
Yes. As I say, we start during the day of transplant, before the transplant in the kidney. And we give them intravenously. Their induction medications, basically what they do is they kill your T cells in your white blood cells. If you don't have T cells, you cannot reject. That's how we start. The maintenance immunosuppressive medications are three right now. One is calcineurin inhibitors, the other one is antimetabolites, and the third one is steroids. What April said is absolutely right. The difference between 20 years ago and right now is the medications that we give, immunosuppressive medications to the patients, and our better understanding of how to choose the appropriate donor and recipients and how to take care of them. Surgery has not changed at all. Actually, the first transplant, which was in 1954, was done exactly the same way that I do the transplants right now. The technique hasn't changed. It's the medications that now changed, and that affected the outcome. Right now, more than 60% of our patients are not on any steroids. That's what April was talking about. In the old days, you could tell a patient who had a kidney transplant, or any kind of transplant for that matter, from a mile away because of the facies they have. They had hirsutism. They have buffalo hump. It's called moon facies. We don't have those things anymore because we don't give them steroids. But the medications we give them, yes, they have some side effects, but not the dose that we give them. In the old days, again, 20 years ago, for example, when I first started doing these things, we had no way of measuring the blood levels of these immunosuppressive medications. So we used to give the same amount of medication to everybody and hope for the best. Now we measure their blood levels and adjust the medication accordingly, the dose that we give. So that's why we don't see those side effects anymore.
Do these recipients still have a higher chance of developing infectious disease? Is their resistance still diminished somewhat to infectious disease? And is there any issue of lymphoproliferative cancers as there used to be in the past as a result of the medications?
Well, obviously, that's always there and will be there. Those patients are at increased risk for infection and lymphoproliferative diseases. But again, the amount of immunosuppressive that we give is basically prevents them almost from having those things. For example, in my program, our infectious disease rate in our immunosuppressive patients, transplant patients, and our lymphoproliferative disease rate is less than 1%.
Wow. Valerie, what is the long-term follow-up you do with these patients? I assume you're not only measuring the blood levels of the medications and checking their kidney function, and I would assume there'd be medical exams to make sure there aren't any other secondary diseases coming about. You have a long-term relationship with these people?
We do. For the recipients, we actually monitor these patients lifelong. Dr. Ducker is our medical director, and for instance, like the first month after transplant, patients are seen in our clinic twice a week and also blood work twice a week. First 3 months are the most critical, and so they come into our office very, very frequently. That's, you know, we get to know the families and also the patients very, very well, which is the nice part about my job, is because you get to know these patients for these patients. But yes, we follow them lifelong, and we have some patients who are 30 years post-transplant, and we still see them at least once a year.
And it's been stated that 10 to 25% of transplants result in an acute rejection phenomenon. How often do you see it? And when you see it, apparently this can generally be handled with the medications?
Well, normally these days, with again, the new immunosuppressive medications, our better understanding of how to use them, our ability to monitor their blood levels, the rejection rate, acute rejection rate, should be less than 15%, actually. In our program, our rejection rate is currently 9%, which is better than the national standards.
We need to take a quick break for the news on Health 360 Midday Matters, but we'll be back in just about 5 minutes here on the program. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment about kidney transplants, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We'll be back in just a few moments.
A failing school district in El Paso, Texas, reported dramatic improvements. What was behind that apparent success?
We had a superintendent who engaged in criminal activity and worked with others inside the district to commit that crime.
The cheating scandal that put him in federal prison and left the school in turmoil. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News. This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. A federal housing official in Fort Wayne says the automatic federal budget cuts are expected to slice about a third of local funding for federal housing vouchers for low-income residents. Fort Wayne Housing Authority Executive Director Maynard Scales says the agency will receive only 67% of the funding it had expected to get for Section 8 housing vouchers. He tells the Journal-Gazette the agency will face some stark times because of those funding reductions. The Housing Authority was paid about $1.4 million last year to operate the Section 8 program, which handles about 2,900 vouchers that allow low-income people to rent an apartment where the landlord accepts the vouchers. Tenants pay 30% of their income toward the rent, while the federal government pays the rest. A change approved by the Indiana Senate Tuesday to legislation overhauling Indiana's criminal code will give less latitude to judges when deciding sentences, even for some low-level offenses. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith has our story.
When the criminal code bill came to the Senate floor, only the worst of the worst offenses, murder and level one felonies, were ineligible for suspended sentences. An amendment offered by Logansport Republican Randy Head also restricts the ability of judges to suspend sentences of those convicted of all but the lowest level of felonies if the person has a previous conviction. Indianapolis Democrat Greg Taylor says the change hurts the very goal of the criminal code revision, focusing more on rehabilitation than incarceration.
All this amendment does is takes discretion out of the hands of the judge to make a good decision about whether or not a person goes to jail or goes to some other program.
But Senator Head says too much focus is being placed on low-level offenses and not enough on how his amendment affects those who commit crimes such as arson, child molestation, and burglary.
The way this bill is written right now, every single one of those offenders could get probation after they were convicted of that crime. And that's not what I think the aim of House Bill 10,006 is.
Bedford Republican Brent Steele, the bill's sponsor, says he thinks as negotiations on the bill progress, some of Head's amendment will be removed. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And the perennial debate over Indiana's time zone continues as a northern Indiana school district has become the latest member of a coalition seeking to put Indiana in the central time zone out of concerns about children waiting for buses in the dark. The Goshen School Board voted on Monday to add Goshen Community Schools to the Central Time Coalition's list of more than 40 Indiana school systems that support observing Central Standard Time in Indiana during the winter and Central Daylight Time the rest of the year. A resolution passed by the Goshen School Board says more morning sunlight would benefit learning readiness. You're listening to Midday Matters here on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOY 89.1 FM. It's 1242, and we'd love to hear from you with any questions or comments about kidney transplants, 260-452-1185, or email us middaymatters@nipr.fm. Don't forget we have our Facebook page, Midday Matters. Before we continue on to the conversation, we just got a nice comment from a listener, Lisa. She says that she gave her brother a kidney 5 years ago, and throughout the time that he got the kidney, he actually developed skin cancer, but he went through chemo and is perfectly fine. And the kidney is still there and had no rejection. And it was considered, and he's fine from skin cancer now and still has the kidney that was donated. So another successful kidney transplant story. If you have one, we'd love to hear it. 260-452-1185, or you can email us middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Dr. Kosilacek, you apparently do have a very low acute reaction rate in your program, but when you do have an acute reaction, what do you do at that point? How do you treat the patient? What are the eventual outcomes?
No matter what we do, the success rate is never 100%. Rejection is never eliminated. There's always the risk of rejection. The important thing is, as Valerie said, to see the patients very frequently and closely follow them up initially the first 3 months so that we can catch rejection if there is one. We can treat rejection successfully in about 90% of the cases if we can diagnose it early. And the medications actually we give them for the treatment of rejection are almost the same medications that we give them to prevent rejection.
At a higher dose?
At a higher dose, at a different combinations, yes.
And if the patient, if this fails, do you remove the kidney?
So let's say no matter what, we couldn't treat the rejection and the kidneys eventually failed. Normally, if it's a chronic rejection, which means this rejection happened in a longer period of time, let's say years after the transplant, we usually leave the kidney in, because those kidneys don't cause any problem. If it's an acute rejection, happens in a short amount of time, then yes, we have to take those kidneys out so that there won't be excessive antibody load in the body, which would prevent us from getting another kidney to the recipient.
And those patients will go on dialysis and go back on your transplantation
list. That's correct.
In the literature, they talk about chronic rejection, and what I was reading, they said they really don't understand that. Rejection that takes place several years down the line. Is there anything new as to the understanding of this phenomenon?
Well, there have been studies going on. Actually, the majority of studies right now is to better understand chronic rejection and to be able to treat it. But basically, what we can say is, no matter what we do, this is not man-made. This is not God-made. This is man-made. So we're not perfect. Even the medications that we give, which prevent rejection, have side effects and, I would say, they're, in a sense, bad on the kidneys. In the long run, they hurt the kidney. So when you were talking about chronic rejection, some of them happen because of the medications, actually, we give them to prevent rejection. And then some of them are the reaction to our immune system to the organ that was placed. Let me put it this way. Your body doesn't know the difference between a life-saving organ, which is heart, lung, liver, kidney, pancreas, and the difference between a virus or a bacteria. Your immune system asks one question, is this one on my own or not? Well, the answer is no. Then the Department of Defense sends the order to go and kill it. That's basically how it works. Now, what we're trying to do is prevent this thing from happening. So we tell the immune system, hey, just don't pay attention to this kidney, leave it alone. But it's not possible on the long run, and it's not possible 100%. That's what it is.
And April, you said your father did have a difficulty with one of the medications that was causing a mild rejection, and once that was changed, things were okay?
Correct. He started to see his creatinine levels creeping up, and so they did a biopsy of my kidney and noticed that one of the medications it was almost an allergic reaction to, so they switched his medications and his levels went back down, and they've been down ever since.
Wonderful. It was just pointed out to me that you have an advocate in this whole process, that there's a belief that the donor, of course, should donate under their own will and not be coerced in any way, and it's almost an, you have an independent advocate out of the system per se. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, that's correct. I had my own nephrologist, and I had my own set of doctors that evaluated me for the procedure, because it's impossible for the recipient surgeon to stay unbiased because he needs an organ for his patient. And so in order to remove all bias and any complications, we had separate doctors, and I had an advocate that called me, and I met with a social worker to make sure that I was doing this process uncoerced. I wasn't being forced to, or there was nothing attached to the surgery. It was just because of what I wanted to do.
And you mentioned that if you ever needed a kidney yourself, if your kidney failed you, what would happen?
If I ever was in a position where I needed a kidney, the is it UNOS?
Yeah.
Corporation or foundation would move me to the top of the list. I would, because of my past donation, I would be moved to the very top of the transplant list.
So that's another reason why people who are donating kidneys should really not fear for their future health issues too, because there'd be maximal support if something were to go wrong.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that was one of the things also that helped my dad to be able to be okay with the decision. The fact that donors have a longer life expectancy than the normal population. It's not a complicated or dangerous surgery. And if I ever was in a situation where I needed a kidney, I would be immediately moved to the top of the list.
I would like to add something to what April said, and it's exactly true. These days, complication risk of donating a kidney for transplant purposes is actually less than getting your appendix or your gallbladder taken out.
Fantastic. What do you see, Dr. Kozelicek, for in the future of transplantation surgery? As mentioned, nationally, about 25% of patients requiring transplants have diabetes. You said locally in Indiana, it's almost 70% of the patients have diabetes or hypertension. They talk about doing pancreatic transplants along with the kidney transplant. Do you see this coming up in this region too?
Well, let's start like this. Right now, there are more than 95,000 people waiting for a kidney transplant nationally. The total of people waiting for all transplants combined is about 110,000. Mm. Every day in this country, 19 people die waiting for an organ. Every day. That's what it is. The gap between people needing a transplant and the number of organs available is increasing every day.
And how many surgeries are done per year in the United States, transplant surgeries?
I can talk about the kidneys. There are roughly about last year it was 6,500 donors in the country. 6,500 donors makes about 13,000 kidneys. Mm-hmm. And then add the living donor kidney transplants to this. I'm estimating somewhere between 20,000 to 22,000 every year kidney transplants, but 95,000 people waiting for a kidney. So that's what it is. Now, when it comes to diabetes and hypertension, when we look at our patient population, 34% of our recipients were hypertensive, 35% of them were diabetic. So combined, they make more than 70%. For type 1 diabetics, obviously, pancreas transplant is an option. And because we know that diabetes is number one cause of end-stage renal disease, so actually long-term diabetics, the kidneys also is in failure. So then we do a kidney and pancreas transplant together.
Usually from a deceased donor, but I read that they're now doing partial pancreatic living donor transplantations. Is this occurring?
That's research. That's in experimental phase. We can do a kidney and pancreas transplant from the same cadaver donor. It's called simultaneous kidney pancreas transplant. Or you can, if the recipient has a potential kidney donor, then you can do a kidney transplant, living donor kidney transplant from a living donor, and then put the patient on the list for a pancreas after kidney transplant, and in a second surgery, do a pancreas transplant.
We need Excellent. To take a quick break on the program, but we'll be back with more of Health 360. If you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
On the next Fresh Air, the evolution of the new military intelligence complex, in which the CIA does targeted killings and the military's special forces take on spying missions. We talk with Mark Mazzetti, a national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Peter Sagal here. It is so frustrating that I've been doing the show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, for so long, and I don't know what you all look like. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to simulcast our show live from New York City on May 2nd to theaters all over the country. And I want you to come to the theater. I want you to stare at the screen. And if I peer into the camera hard enough, I think I'll be able to see you. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, live in theaters on May 2nd.
There's more information about the Wait, Wait Cinema event at nipr.fm.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
Welcome back to the program. It's 12:54, and this is Health 360 Midday Matters on WBOY 89.1 FM. If you have a question or comment, feel free to write in. We only have about 5 minutes left in today's program. You can do that by going to our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or emailing us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
As the goal of our program today, obviously, is to increase the awareness and understanding of living organ donation in not only our listening population, but hopefully this can be carried out on a national level with people understanding that this is a very safe and effective procedure. How does your organization get the word out, and how do you approach the dialysis population? It's my understanding that chronic long-term dialysis is extremely expensive, and kidney transplantation surgery is in today's financially aware medical world far more cost-effective than long-term dialysis. How do you approach this with those patients?
What we tell for recipients is that you know, do not be shy about the kidney transplant, that you need one. We tell patients that just spread the word, and you never know on who's going to make that phone call. Even, you know, patients going to church and doing like a need prayers because they're awaiting a transplant, that, you know, I have donors who step forward and say, you know, I know so-and-so, I'm interested in some information. For a living donor, they just have to call our office and talk to myself, and I'm more than happy to answer any type of questions they might have. And some patients, you know, some living donors aren't 100% positive, but that's where the education aspect comes in from my standpoint.
And I would like to add something to that. You talked about the financial part of transplant. We now know that kidney transplant is also save lives, gives an extra quality of life, and extends a dialysis patient's life expectancy minimum of 8 to 10 years. That's one part. The second part is comparing financially. Dialysis costs about $75,000 a year until the patient dies. Kidney transplant first year cost is about $120,000. Starting the second year, yearly cost is only $10,000. So when you look at that, kidney transplant crosses dialysis at about 16 to 18 months. And after that, it's much more cost effective. And the patients have a better quality of life and they live longer.
A recent analysis showed that $17 billion a year is spent by our government on dialysis programs, and it makes up 10% of the current Medicare budget. So really and truly, as Dr. Kozilishek just pointed out, kidney transplantation is far more cost-effective, aside from the fact that it greatly improves the quality of life of these individuals. April, how's your dad doing? Is he working? Is he traveling? What's happening now, a year later?
Absolutely. My dad's back to work, and he's traveling. He's been several vacations, you know, away, and is able to take his medications with him without any difficulties. Even traveling on an airplane with his medications has been okay. He can do anything that he wants to do. He exercises. He has a very active lifestyle. I did want to say just one little thing about the financial aspect of it. As a donor, there is zero cost involved. I received a card as soon as I signed up for the program, and every appointment that I went to, I presented the card, and all of it was billed through my dad's insurance. There were zero bills sent to me. I saw none of the financial part of the surgery. I think that that's, if that's a concern, it hasn't affected my insurance or any of those types of things at all.
And is there help for the recipient in terms of cost beyond their own health insurance?
For if a patient is on dialysis and they are primary Medicare, they also receive another card, like what April received. So actually their testing is actually billed through Medicare. For the transplant medications afterwards, we always have those patient assistance programs if needed. So we have definitely the funds or definitely the research available to help the patients out anyways.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all so much for being a part of Health 360 today. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 and HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Thanks very much for listening today. The podcast will be available by the end of today at nipr.fm. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.